Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Your family budget, your ability to fill up your tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war and commits genocide a half a world away.
Did you catch that? The president used the G word, genocide, for the first time when talking about the situation in Ukraine at an event last Tuesday in Iowa. The president later doubled down on his rhetoric to reporters.
Yes, I called it genocide because it's become clearer and clearer that Putin is just trying to wipe out the idea of even being able to be a Ukrainian.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. It was a surprising shift in language. It was only a week after President Biden showed reluctance to call Russian violence in Ukraine genocide.
No, I think it is a war crime.
What are you going to do about it, sir? Are you going to do more sanctions on Russia?
I'm seeking more sanctions, yes.
Technically, it's up to international lawyers to make the determination of genocide. Still, President Biden's declaration is significant. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky praised Biden as a, quote, true leader. Meanwhile, other world leaders are steering clear of the word genocide. French Prime Minister Emmanuel Macron went so far as to warn against, quote, an escalation of rhetoric.
Je veux essayer au maximum de continuer à pouvoir arrêter cette guerre et à rebâtir la paix. Donc
Macron says there, I want to try my best to continue to be able to stop this war and rebuild peace. So I'm not sure the escalation of words is helping the cause right now. I think there's one thing that can be said with certainty, and that is that the situation is unacceptable and that these are war crimes. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, there have been grim reports of bodies in the streets, mass graves, and the targeting of civilians. According to the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, there have been at least 4,450 civilian casualties, including 1,892 deaths. Horrifying? Yes. But does this amount to genocide? Who gets to decide, and what are the consequences if it is? Those are the questions we are unpacking this hour on Point. And I do want to note that our conversation will include the topic of sexual violence. Kate Cronin-Furman is an associate professor of human rights at the University College London and author of the forthcoming book, Hypocrisy and Human Rights. Kate, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Eugene Finkel, Associate Professor of International Affairs at Johns Hopkins University. Eugene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with you, Eugene. You recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post titled, What's Happening in Ukraine is Genocide, period. Can you elaborate on why you think it's such a clear-cut case?
All right, thank you. So earlier you said that it is for international lawyers to decide whether genocide is happening. And I actually disagree with that. Genocide is definitely a legal term, but it's also a political term. It's a moral term, and it's an analytical term. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm a scholar of the Holocaust and genocide more broadly. I'm also a scholar of Eastern Europe, specifically Russia and Ukraine. And when I wrote this op-ed, I used this, both my knowledge of genocide and what it is, and also my knowledge of Eastern Europe, how it works, how Russia works, and also evidence that we were seeing on the ground. Now, more specifically, why I think that what we see does fit the definition of genocide is because the definition is very simple. The definition, the UN definition, is acts committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group in whole and part as such. And I think what we see in Ukraine is that the targeting of civilians is not random. there are clear patterns that we do see. Yes, there are many people who are being killed in what we can call indiscriminate violence. You know, someone who did not shelling, or someone who did not stop at a checkpoint, or Russian soldiers wanted to loot their house and kill them. But there are also quite a lot of evidence that people are targeted quite deliberately. So people who, and especially people who associated with Ukrainian national identity and with the Ukrainian state. So teachers, state officials, those who explicitly self-identify as Ukrainians, veterans of the Ukrainian military. So that for me was one part of the evidence, and it came from different places. It wasn't just an isolated massacre. And second, I think we have clear information about the intent, because it's all over Russian media and it's all over the things that Russian state officials are saying. It didn't start this way. I mean, at the beginning, they were talking about Ukraine being an artificial state and talking about regime change, and that's, I'm pretty sure, what they wanted to achieve when they invaded Ukraine. But once they encountered pretty stiff Ukrainian resistance, we saw rhetoric shifting in Russia, not only in the state media, but also by state officials like former President Medvedev, who is now the vice chairman of the Russian Security Council, to denazification, or that's the official goal of the Russian campaign in the media ecosphere, to denazification being de-Ukrainization. And it's pretty actionable, to the extent that, you know, national elites should be liquidated. People, I mean, the general population should be punished. They should suffer ideological repression. They should be re-educated. We also see evidence of curriculum being switched from Ukrainian to Russian, or separatist burning books. So yeah. Here we do see this clear intent to destroy Ukrainians as a national group.
So, Kate, I want to step back just for a moment more broadly. We will talk more about the specifics of what's happening in Ukraine. But I want to ask you how you would define genocide. I will note that Eugene pointed, his definition is from the 1948 Genocide Convention, which defines genocide as crimes committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. Now, I am a lawyer, not an international one, but it's still, even when you have a clear-cut definition, that doesn't mean that it's easy to identify it. Kate, how do you do so?
So, yes. So Eugene has given the convention definition, which is it hinges on this intent to destroy an identity group. And that can mean mass killing, which I think is what most people think of when they hear the word genocide. And often we do see genocidal intent manifest in mass killing. It can also mean the infliction of severe physical or mental trauma. Importantly, for what we are seeing in Ukraine, it can mean measures to prevent births within the group, and it can mean forcible transfer of children away from the group. So any of these acts with that intent to destroy can equal genocide.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, you know, when we try to figure out if mass atrocities are genocidal, we are looking for that intent to destroy.
And how do you identify that intent, Kate? That seems like that's a very difficult thing to be in the minds of whoever is directing this sort of onslaught.
Yes, and it makes genocide much, much harder to prove in court than, say, war crimes or crimes against humanity. So sometimes it's not that difficult, right? So in the case of the Holocaust, there was loads of documentary evidence showing that the extermination of the Jews was both German state policy and the specific intent of any number of Nazi officials. But usually we don't have that kind of smoking gun evidence that we would want. And then courts have to infer from context. So in the case of Rwanda, for instance, the International Criminal Tribunal inferred from the scale and the systematicity with which Tutsis were being targeted that this was an extermination plan. And that was backed up by testimony that perpetrators had said things like they needed to wipe out Tutsis so that future generations of Hutu children would never know what a Tutsi looked like.
Mm. So, Eugene, how do you differentiate between genocide and other atrocities such as ethnic cleansing and war crimes?
So I think genocide does consist of war crimes, but goes beyond war crimes. And the key difference between genocide and ethnic cleansing is that genocide is an intent to destroy an identity group regardless of geography or location. Ethnic cleansing is primarily about territory or destroying a group that is linked to a specific territory, but once the territory is ethnically cleansed, so to speak, then the perpetrators lose their main difference in this group. And genocide is not territorial. For genocide, the idea is the goal is to destroy members of the group or to destroy the group regardless of where they are.
And Kate, how and why does a government declare something a genocide? What does it mean? What does that change?
So this is something that the U.S. has done, the U.S. government has done a handful of times in the last 20 or 30 years, which is to officially label acts genocide. It's worth noting here that there is no official policy that underlies this, and there's also no formal process. So it's a little bit opaque what exactly this means and why the U.S. does it. But we have seen it previously with regard to Bosnia, with regard to Rwanda, with regard to the attacks on Kurds in Iraq, Darfur, ISIS attacks on the Yazidi, and most recently with the Biden administration, the genocide against the Uyghurs and against the Rohingya.
And Eugene, why does the definition have to be so strict? Why do we have to be so careful in what we call genocide?
Well, I don't think it has to be so strict. And one of the reasons why I'm so critical of this definition is that it is artificially strict. And we know why it is strict, because it is a legal document, but it's also a political document that was adopted by the UN in 1948. And it reflected the interests of UN members and especially UN Security Council members back in 1948. That's, for instance, the reason why political groups that were in the draft of the convention are not included in the final list, because Soviet Union was actively destroying political groups and did not want to have them in the definition. But if I were to...
I'm going to pause you right there, and we're going to come back on the other side and discuss this more. We are talking about genocide, what it is, whether or not that's what's happening in Ukraine, and who gets to decide. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking today about the politics of calling the Russian invasion of Ukraine a genocide. With us is Kate Cronin-Furman. She's Associate Professor of Human Rights at the University College London, and Eugene Finkel. He's Associate Professor of International Affairs at Johns Hopkins University. Eugene, I apologize for interrupting your point, but I want to let you finish your point about the legal definition of genocide.
Right. Thank you. So what I started saying is that there is absolutely no analytical reason to have only those groups. And I think if we ever update this definition, we should also include definitely political groups, but also gender groups, sexual orientation groups, other identity groups. But in a way, this is what the definition is. And no matter how unhappy I am about this definition, in my view, what we see in Ukraine does fit it.
So, Eugene and Kate, let's step back for a moment and look at another genocide that was recently recognized by the Biden administration. Last April, President Biden declared the mass killing of Armenians during the First World War a genocide. But in the over 100 years leading up to that moment, there was a lot of politics that delayed that recognition. Peter Balakian is a professor of humanities at Colgate University and author of The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. And he spent decades combating the Turkish government's denial of the Armenian Genocide.
In 2007, I was involved in the conversations with members of Congress at that time. Turkey was so terrified of a non-binding statement that acknowledged the Armenian genocide, that the Turkish government was threatening to close down missile bases that were perched at the Iraqi and other sensitive areas at the Iraqi border. And they were threatening to cut hundreds of millions of dollars of defense contracts. You know, they were even noting at times that they couldn't guarantee the safety of the lives of Americans in Turkey if this were going to be ratified. So the levels of hysteria and paranoia were playing out at very kind of ground zero military and diplomatic levels. And the State Department has always been the part of the US government that has caved to Turkey. That's the place where the greatest fear and anxiety has been. Congress, not so much. The White House, not so much. I mean, the White House often has followed the State Department's requests on this because Turkey's threatening, you know, to upbraid U.S.-Middle East relations. The State Department got so exorcised by Turkish anger and hysteria that the State Department asked every living Secretary of State, this I guess goes back to Kissinger, down through Madeleine Albright, to sign a letter begging Congress and the President not to affirm this resolution. And so the resolution died, not in a vote, it was just pulled. Mostly I heard from people, though, in Congress that they felt this was right and important, and that they felt that it was out of their control because the desks at the State Department were pushing back and making statements that, you know, this would be too disruptive to international politics. I never had any direct contact with State Department people. But it was very wounding and even, and I would say, tragic for our government to not be able to stand up to such bullying from a foreign nation with such a horrible human rights record.
Peter Balakian. He's Pulitzer Prize winning poet and professor of the humanities at Colgate University. He's also author of The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide, and America's Response. And regarding that 2007 non-binding statement that was pulled, reporters later found that former House Speaker Dennis Hastert had played a major role in that. After his retirement from Congress, he went to work for Turkish lobbyists on a $35,000 a month contract to defeat efforts to recognize the Armenian Genocide. In an unrelated instance in 2016, Hastert was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison for a case linked to allegations he sexually abused teen boys. So, Kate, I want to focus on the political aspect of calling something a genocide. And I want to start with why the term genocide has become so charged and controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I think for many people, the word genocide connotes that something is like the Holocaust, right? Which is considered, you know, one of the worst crimes in human history, a moral stain on the conscience of mankind. So to say genocide, to say that a situation is a genocide, is to say that it is like the one event that virtually everyone agrees was deserving of intervention. So for victims and, you know, for victims' advocates, being able to get recognition of a mass atrocity as genocide means that they are signaling by analogy that the situation demands action. And given the apathy and inertia with which serious violations of human rights are often met, it makes sense that persecuted groups would see this label as the best hope of action and intervention.
Yeah, Eugene, in your piece, you write that genocide is, quote, the crime of crimes. Talk about how its importance in shaping public opinion, international public opinion.
I think it is hugely important, at least at the rhetorical level. We still don't know whether President Biden's statement has led or will lead to any meaningful action, but rhetorically does capture global attention, and it is the reason why, as Kate said, activists from victim nations or victims group would want to have their suffering labeled a genocide, because the moment you use the G word, then all the attention, all the spotlight is on that. And that is the reason why we're having this discussion. Had President Biden said that, you know, war crimes are being committed in Ukraine, or atrocities, crime, or even crimes against humanity, I doubt, you know, the attention and the discussion would be the same as after him using the genocide label.
So, Kate, in the last century, there have been three cases that have met the international court's threshold of genocide. Can you talk about those situations meeting the legal definition?
So we've had a number of instances in which international courts have found people guilty of genocide. And, you know, just to say, once upon a time, I was a lawyer, so I do kind of have this residual technical approach, which is that genocide is a crime to be proved in a court of law. So we've seen individuals held responsible for genocide at the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. We've seen it at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. We've also seen the ICJ concur that genocide was committed in the case of Srebrenica. And we have, I actually can't remember whether we have a ruling yet, but we have had discussion of genocide in the case of Cambodia by the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia.
And so, Eugene, we heard the president, differentiate between what he considers genocide and also at the same time saying, you know, leaving it to the lawyers to decide what is legally genocide. Do you see a difference there, a difference in importance in saying it, whether or not that legal determination has been made?
Right. So I think it is important to call a genocide a genocide if we believe that it does fit the definition, even though proving it in the court of law might become hard, precisely because of the political component and the political and moral way for this word, because it mobilizes for action, because it captures attention. So I think President Biden was absolutely right to call it a genocide, but only if it will be followed by meaningful action. Otherwise, talking the talk without walking the walk would, in my view, actually do more damage, not only for Ukraine and Ukrainians, but also for victims of future genocide, because in a sense, it will cheapen what we mean by genocide and the way that the word, the term carries politically and morally, even not as much legally.
On Thursday, On Point host Meghna Chakrabarty asked former ambassador to Ukraine Bill Taylor if what was happening in Ukraine amounted to genocide. Here's what he told her.
Absolutely. We remember President Putin leaning over to President Bush saying, George, the Ukraine is not, it's not really a nation, and he believes it's not really a nation, and he's wiping out that nation. He's taking steps to kill Ukrainians, civilians, women, children, schools, hospitals. So he has the intent to wipe out this nation, and he is acting on it. That's genocide.
So, Kate, it seems pretty clear here. We're hearing from a lot of current and former U.S. officials that this is genocide. But why has the United States historically been reluctant to name something a genocide? Are we seeing the same thing happening now as we've seen in previous administrations?
So we have this really notorious example, right, where it took the U.S. government 6 weeks to say the word genocide with regard to what happened in Rwanda in 1994, and really kind of tied themselves in knots to avoid using the word. And that was based on a perception that it would result in a sort of moral duty to act, right? I want to note here that the U.S. government has been very clear that it does not believe labeling decisions, so the decision to call something genocide, has legal consequences, right? So the U.S. government does not think that once it has called something a genocide, it has any obligation to do anything that it wasn't already required to do. However, you know, there is, as Eugene has said, there is this perception of a moral duty to act, right? So there has been this reluctance to use this really powerful word, simply because it then might result in pressure to engage in ways that the government is not ready to do.
And speaking of this situation in Myanmar, on March 22nd, 2022, at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the Biden administration's determination that Myanmar's military committed genocide and crimes against humanity against the Rohingya.
One of my responsibilities as Secretary is determining on behalf of the United States whether atrocities have been committed. It's an immense responsibility that I take very seriously, particularly given my family's history. Beyond the Holocaust, the United States has concluded that genocide was committed 7 times. Today marks the 8th, as I have determined that members of the Burmese military committed genocide and crimes against humanity against Rohingya.
So, Eugene, I want to connect that to what's happening in the situation in Ukraine. Why is it a debate in some places and not in others?
What do you mean by some places but not others? Those.
Well, how does the determination here about what's happening with the Rohingya in genocide? Do you see commonalities or differences in the way that the U.S. is responding?
So first of all, we should know that it took the U.S. quite some time to determine that what is happening to Rohingya is a genocide, and conveniently, it also removes quite a lot of the pressure to intervene. Here's the difference, and I'm not an expert on Myanmar. That's regionally much closer to Kate's focus. But from what I see, the key difference is that this determination, at least politically, has been made during the violence, so hopefully that would lead to some more meaningful action rather than just, you know, making a statement by Secretary of State without, to the best of my knowledge, any meaningful consequences.
Kate, why do consequences not flow from this determination?
Can I actually speak to the previous point really quickly? Would you mind?
Sure.
Yeah, because no. I actually was a consultant on this massive report that the Holocaust Memorial Museum did about the instances in which the U.S. has done these genocide determinations, because it is a little bit of a mystery, right, why it happens sometimes and not others. So, you know, for instance, I do a lot of work with the Sri Lankan Tamil community, which at the end of the war in 2009 suffered horrific civilian casualties as a result of intentional actions by the Sri Lankan government. And it's a little bit curious why a situation like that has never been considered for a genocide determination process, whereas, you know, many other comparable situations are. And, you know, the question you asked Eugene, you know, why does that happen in some cases and not others? It's very much politics, right? It has a lot to do with, you know, who the perpetrator and victim groups are, whether it lines up with other U.S. policy imperatives, whether it militates against other U.S. policy imperatives. And in the Rohingya case, in fact, you know, this was a very rigorous research process that was undertaken 3.5 years ago, under the Trump administration, in fact, where they did an incredible amount of documentation and analysis and then issued no determination. And there was no explanation for why that happened. And then under the Biden administration, they sort of brought the process back to life, went through the documentation and the analysis, and issued a determination that indeed genocide had occurred. So this is very much a contingent sort of process. It's not formalized, and it can depend both on the politics of the situation and also just kind of bureaucratic stuff going on within the government.
We heard earlier Emmanuel Macron express his reluctance, beyond reluctance, saying that it's unhelpful to call it genocide. Eugene, is there a danger of escalation by using these words?
Escalation in terms of having more people killed than already are? No, I don't think so. I don't think that Russian policy in Ukraine, especially the killings on the ground, are very much motivated or driven by how we call it. And if we agree that at the very least atrocity crimes or crimes against humanity and possibly even genocide is happening in Ukraine, then I don't think it's possible to escalate any further in terms of violence. So no, I don't think it is a real concern, actually.
All right, we're discussing the politics of calling what's happening in Ukraine genocide. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. We're spending this hour looking at the history of genocide, as well as whether or not genocide is happening in Ukraine. With me here are Kate Cronin-Furman, an associate professor of human rights at the University College London, and Eugene Finkel, associate professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. So I want to start with a comment on Facebook from a listener, Gary Constantine, who writes, "War is hell. call it what you want, there's always meant to be killings of civilians, much of it intentional, and to minimize younger generations that might eventually be interested in payback, as we've seen throughout history in all kinds of cultures. That said, what's coming in the next stage of this war is likely to be far worse, so if one is hesitant about calling out a genocide, you soon will be, and then we'll all be asking ourselves how we could have let that happen without barely doing anything. So, Kate, this sort of gets not only to looking backwards in history, which teaches us so much why often these things are declared after the fact, but it also speaks to how difficult it is to recognize it in real time, and how certain acts, like you pointed out, separating children from their families can be genocidal, and other things. Can you help people sort of point out how they can recognize when it's happening in real time rather than only in hindsight?
Yes, although let me kind of just caveat it with saying, you know, mass atrocities are horrific regardless of whether they constitute the crime of genocide. So people who have suffered crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, all of them are deserving of our attention, of our solidarity. They're deserving of accountability to the same level. That said, you know, it is always important to call things what they are. And in the case of genocide, it's important to know that we're seeing it when we're seeing it because, you know, if we don't call it correctly, then we can't respond correctly. So when we look at a case like Ukraine, it is clear that Russia is committing terrible violations of war, of the laws of war and human rights. And when we look at something like what we saw in Bucha, right, with these kind of just horrific photographs of civilians who had been, you know, shot at close range, we can be pretty certain we're seeing war crimes, right? There's no way that that's legal under the laws of war. We also can be fairly sure that we're seeing crimes against humanity because these acts look widespread and systematic. It is possible we are seeing genocidal acts pending that investigation into the specific intent to destroy. However, when we look at some of the other things that we're starting to hear about, the picture is getting a bit clearer. So we have heard just devastating testimony from victims of sexual violence who have reported that perpetrators said things to them about how they were raping them so that they would never want to have sexual contact with a man again and they would not bear more Ukrainian children. That is genocidal language. When we hear that children are being taken away from their family to be raised as Russian instead of Ukrainian, that is an act that is in the Genocide Convention. So these are what we look to be able to differentiate from crimes against humanity or, you know, ethnic cleansing is a term a lot of people know, versus genocide.
And Eugene, given evidence like Kate is talking about, why is it that so often genocide is only declared after the fact? Why does it often take so long to get that recognition?
Right. So one of them, to add to the great points that Kay just made, one of the key things that we need to determine is the intent. And usually intent is very hard to prove, especially at the higher levels, because people who engage in those war crimes tend to be aware of the potential responsibility and accountability. So to prove intent beyond reasonable doubt, either legal or academic, we need to have access to quite a lot of materials, to quite a lot of evidence. But in this case, I think what differentiates this case is how open the Russian government is, and people in the Russian government and the Russian media, how open they are about their intent, including state news agencies and state media and state officials, either talking explicitly about wiping out the very idea of Ukrainian nations, or just yesterday, the unit that performed those horrible mass killings in Bucha got designated a guards unit by President Putin, which is the most elite military designation for a unit in the Russian military. Now, of course, the Russian government does deny that any mass violence happened, but it's more like a wink, wink. We know what happened. Here, take your price. So in that mm-hmm. sense, I think what makes Ukraine different is how easy to prove intent in this case is. You know, as a genocide scholar, I never even imagined that I would see a government almost, you know, advertising genocide. But here they're doing the work for us. But in other cases, and Kate is absolutely right, proving intent is much harder.
So, Eugene, in your piece, you write, among other things, that the intent may have changed in this case, that the initial incursion may have been more about territory. But once it became clear that the Ukrainians were going to fight back, something changed. Is that something that often happens in a genocidal situation?
I think it does happen. Off the top of my head, can't think about the exact number, but for instance, an argument that is made by several scholars of Armenian genocide. We had Professor Balakian before talking about the Armenian genocide, but the argument that is being made by historians that it did not start as a genocide, but it evolved into genocide. So in that sense, I do not think that it is unique. And some scholars of the Holocaust would even say that, yes, Hitler definitely won't remove Jews from Germany and then from Europe, but physical extermination of the Jews, their idea of physically killing them all, came only much, much later.
So, Kate, we've discussed already the fact that declaring something to be a genocide in and of itself does not automatically lead to any sort of action. But how can accountability be had? How can Ukraine seek justice, and how can Western nations and the UN hold Russia accountable for what is happening?
I think something that is interesting about this particular case and is, you know, different from most of the other contexts that I'm familiar with and most of the other genocides that we've talked about today is that Ukraine is a state, right? Ukrainians are not a marginalized minority within Russia. They are their own country with their own justice system. So as these crimes have been committed, Ukrainian prosecutors and investigators have been taking testimony, gathering forensic evidence, and starting to build case files. So I think, you know, we are very likely to see prosecutions of people implicated in these crimes within the Ukrainian justice system. Additionally, you know, a month ago or so, about 40 countries referred the situation to the International Criminal Court. So the International Criminal Court is also engaged in a process of investigation and preparing to issue charges. So, you know, while obviously the prospect of seeing Putin himself in the dock is not particularly likely, I think, you know, we should expect to see any number of members of the Ukrainian military, you know, mid-level, even higher-level commanders, given that we've got a lot of generals on the field, in the courtroom facing accountability for these crimes.
Eugene, I want to ask you about what accountability would look like to you. I want to also note that you were born in Ukraine.
That's correct. So for me, accountability would mean not just criminal persecution. I would love to see that, but I agree with Kate that we're unlikely to see that in the case of Putin and people around him, but much more likely to see lower-level perpetrators facing accountability. So definitely criminal accountability, but also historical accountability and moral accountability to get the historical record straight, to get all the evidence, to get the voices of the victims heard, recognized, and referring to what happened in Ukraine as a genocide, if we indeed believe that genocide is happening as such, you know, for tens and hundreds of years from now. So for me, accountability is a broader picture and a broader concept beyond just criminal one.
I want to read the text of a voicemail that we got from a listener just in. It says, I think the reason the United States can call something genocide is because they're guilty of war crimes. And it's also a major shift in court there in the United States has been, the United States has been committing war crimes. They don't. They refuse to sign this treaty so they don't have to go before the world court. And I think it's one reason they don't speak out against genocide, because they're guilty themselves. Kate, can you speak to that legal, the fact that that the United States is not a party to the ICC, and in the opinion of this listener, that that plays a role in how, why the U.S. is sometimes reluctant to call something genocide?
I can understand where the listener is coming from, and it is true that, you know, the U.S. has refused to join the International Criminal Court out of concerns over its own soldiers being prosecuted for acts overseas. However, alongside that, the U.S. has always had an enormous human rights bureaucracy within the State Department, has always been a very loud voice, you know, condemning mass atrocities committed by other countries' militaries. And, you know, of course, this often leads to accusations of hypocrisy for exactly the reasons that the listener notes. But I think, you know, it is not fair to say that the U.S. has been reluctant to name things war crimes, to name things crimes against humanity, to name things genocide, out of concerns over its own culpability. I think what we see more frequently is that U.S. strategic and foreign policy concerns may be coloring the willingness to call some situations out and keep silent about others.
A listener on Facebook, Vale Ryan, says, I don't know. I don't think he really cares who or what they are. I think he's talking about Vladimir Putin. He has no issues with the Ukrainians who are on his side. I do know it is criminal and inexcusable. So, Eugene, we've been talking a lot about intent. There's been a lot of talk about how people differ in their assessment in what Vladimir Putin in particular is thinking. How much does getting inside Putin's head have to do with the characterization of this as genocide?
Well, I don't think we need to get that much into his head, because he's quite open about his ideas. I mean, he wrote several quasi-historical articles. He had some speeches in which he talks explicitly about how he views Ukraine as an artificial state, as an invented state, how he does not view Ukrainians as a real nation. So Ukrainians on his side are Russians, essentially, and he just does not accept the idea of Ukrainians being a separate nation with an identity and a will of their own. And again, he and people around him are very explicit about this. It's not something new that they just came up with. It's also present in Russian nationalist thinking and writing and speaking for about 200 years. It just, for most time, it did not lead to actions. And that is the change that we are observing. But we know perfectly well what he's thinking.
So, Eugene, could there be a shift in the evidence of genocide over the course of the war? We already talked about there being seemingly a shift in the intent. Might there also be a shift in what we discover coming out of this, or as this continues, that could change the classification of what this is?
Definitely. We already see more and more evidence as more areas get liberated, or when journalists get access to those areas. And it's absolutely possible that, you know, at some point we discover that actually people who were killed because we think they were killed and targeted because they're Ukrainians, that was not the case. Or we discovered that the actual reasons for the killings had nothing to do with rhetoric in Moscow, and then I will be proven wrong. And then I will have to concede that it is not a genocide, but crimes against humanity. But my intuition, knowing how the Russian military and the Russian state operates, we will actually find more and more evidence of intent, especially by the people on the ground, because right now this is the biggest missing piece. We know the rhetoric at the top. We know that people are killed, and we need to connect those to. So if we need to get into someone's head, it's not Putin, but commanders and soldiers on the ground who are pulling the triggers and killing those people and understand why they're doing that. And for that, we just started to get some evidence. And the evidence is that they are indeed read the Russian media and explicitly motivated by it. I mean, they tell people who they punish or who they target that, you know, we read this Putin speech or that article in the media, and that's why we're killing you, or that's why we're mistreating you. So I think we'll actually see more evidence to support this connection between genocidal rhetoric and actual violence on the ground. But I'm also open to the idea that we might not, and then determination will be wrong. At least my determination will be proven wrong.
Yeah, just a few seconds left, Kate. What are other real-world implications of calling this a genocide beyond the courts?
You know, I honestly think probably the biggest impact, or maybe even the biggest intended impact of Biden's statement may have to do with other states who may have kind of been cautiously supportive of Russia or sitting on the fence, right?
All right, we'll have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. Kate Cronin-Furman is an associate professor at University College London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eugene Fenkel is an associate professor at Johns Hopkins. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.